I have a message from another time. A Reproductions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, A Question of Faith by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. With Anne Cross, Megazone, Philip J. Moyer, and Chris Overstreet. Saturday, February 12th, 2405, Worcester Preparatory Institute, Worcester, Massachusetts, Earth. The Worcester Preparatory Institute Duelist Society was gathered in the place that served it for a clubhouse, the main hall of Alden Memorial, on this windy, blustery Saturday afternoon, to observe an audition of sorts. This was the first time such a thing had been done. The Society's first non-charter member had come with such impeccable references that it hadn't been felt necessary. Now, though, a total unknown had petitioned for membership, and as such, according to the Society's charter, her measure had to be taken by one of the pre-existing members. The duelists and their friends, detractors would say hangers-on, were waiting for the petitioner to arrive. Some were standing around chatting, others sitting up on the stage like children on the tailgate of a pickup truck. Miki Kaworu was nearly unconscious. This could be largely attributed to the fact that he was lying prone on the stage, his head on a cushion, while Azalin Devir-Natashkin scratched his back. The club's two highest officers, President Caitlin Hutchins and Vice President Uchina Tenjo, stood off to one side, conferring about something. Since it was Saturday, they were out of uniform. Kate was dressed in gray jeans and her Coco Martinez jersey, Uchina in her customary black and scarlet. After Christmas, Uchina had finally relented and allowed herself to be taken shopping for civilian clothes other than the several uniforms she still had from her old school. But even now, she still preferred to wear the black jacket of Otori Academy over anything else. Her concession to civilian dress was to wear it with other pants, though they were still red. She'd found several pair of surplus Martian Army battle dress trousers, and occasionally an Art of Noise t-shirt. With her bright pink hair falling down her back, her scarlet pants and her black basket-hilted broadsword hanging at her right side, Uchina was certainly one of the campus's more colorful figures on the weekends. Today she had an additional splash of brightness, since there was a white cat perched on her shoulder. Someone looking at them from across the room might have gotten the impression that the cat was participating in the discussion between the duelist officers. That impression would have been correct. At present, Nall was holding forth on his opinion of the necessity of this exercise. His central theme seemed to be that nobody who could scratch a dragon's ears, Nall insisted he was a dragon, the way the Society's new applicant could, should have any trouble meeting any other eligibility requirements the organization might see fit to impose upon her. Uchina was about to ask with mock petulance if Nall preferred the new girl's ear-scratching talents to her own, when the side door of the auditorium opened and Corwin Ravenhair, Kate's brother and the person whose boon companion Nall claimed to be, entered the room, looked around, and then crossed to his sister's side. As he approached, he bade a good morning to Caitlin and Uchina in turn. "Morning, Corwin," Nall chirped cheerily. "Sleep okay?" Corwin aimed a dark look at the dragon, raised a cautionary finger, and said, "Speak not to me just yet, O disloyal creature." Nall snorted. "Bah," he declared, "you're just jealous." Corwin went a little red and opened his mouth to reply, but he was mercifully interrupted as the main doors of the hall opened and the aspirant duelist arrived. Those assembled at the proscenium murmured a bit among themselves, for the clothes Mia Ausa had arrived dressed in were distinctive. They were not her school uniform, but they were clearly a uniform of some sort. Sturdy leather boots with low heels, functional, mobile, rugged-looking pants and tunic, broad belt and baldric, and a sort of sleeveless trench coat affair, all in a range of browns. That oblong silver pin with the large aqua gemstone on it, the one she'd worn on her school uniform the day before, was affixed to the right side of the coat. She had her ebony hair drawn back and tucked under the bony crest that spanned the back of her skull, Apparently it wasn't attached all the way around. Devlin Carter supposed it beat having to hunt for a scrunchie when he wanted your hair out of your face, but all in all, it looked too high maintenance for his taste. "Whoa," murmured Azalin. "I never noticed that before. What species do you suppose she is?"
"Dunno," Moose McEachern replied. He looked thoughtful. "Those clues look familiar, but I can't place them."
"Minbari," said R. Dorothy Wainwright flatly. "And the Shock battle costume. Final version, circa standard year 520. Amanda Dessler blinked at the robot girl.
"Minbari?"
"Would explain the bone," Azalin mused. "I never saw one with hair before, though."
"Interesting," mused Amanda. "And the Shock. And the Shock," Moose murmured, tapping at his chin. "I know I've seen that word somewhere."
"Aha!" cried a voice from up above. All assembled looked up, to see a brightly clad, brightly colored figure, more colorful even than Utina, standing on the railing along the organ balcony above the main entrance. He was more or less humanoid, except for his elongated, crested, rather pterodactylish head, and his thick, agile tail. His leathery skin was the blue color of a gas flame, and his clothes were scarlet and white and looked like silk. Slung at his left hip was a saber, its gold-plated double-ring hilt gleaming in the chandelier light. With a light, casual-sounding hup, this figure jumped lightly off the edge of the balcony, turned a graceful somersault in midair, and alighted with a bright tick of clawed toes on hardwood a few yards away from Mia. Sweeping his feather-accented tricorner hat from his head, he bowed to her in a courtly way, then straightened and tossed the hat aside so that it hung itself neatly on one of the curtain rope cleats affixed to the theater walls. "Good day to you, Mia Ausa," he declared, standing proudly with his hands on his sword belt. "Welcome again to Alden Memorial. Though I am to be your opponent this day, nevertheless I wish you all good fortune in your test to come. For there is no greater joy, Tutskaya Vorokoshiga'ar Ixtikstakitultko Vryhelt Ishkarat, than to cross swords with a worthy opponent." Mia smiled.
"Thank you, but I'm afraid I don't fight with the sword."
Tskaya made a dismissive gesture. "A figure of speech. The shape of the foe's weapon matters not," he said. "'Tis the struggle itself which fulfills my soul, and the challenge of it."
"Well," said Mia, "I'll try not to disappoint you."
Miki Kaworu, secretary of the society, had been jokingly assigned the afternoon before to find a florist's shop in Worcester which could provide oddly colored roses for the duelists on demand. That morning, in the midst of a dozen distractions, he had, by God, done so. Now Caitlin solemnly affixed a sunburst-colored rose, reminiscent of Sky's own crest colors, to the Scrang's white tabard, and an aqua one matching Mia's gem to the opposite side of her coat, and made a mental note to give the boy genius a raise before reminding herself that he didn't get paid. Utina, who hadn't been present when the jesting suggestion had been made by Kate, thought they were a nice, if rather surreal, touch. Sure, they were really just dyed white roses, nothing like the extremely special roses that had been used for the grand tournament back home, but that was fine. To get roses like that, the Institute Duelist Society itself would have had to be very different, and not in any way Utina would have liked. "The rules are simple. You saw it last night," said Sky, drawing his blade and backing off to his starting place. "Whichever of us loses the rose, loses this duel. Fight hard and make your foundation proud." Mia didn't seem to know quite what to make of that exhortation, so instead she simply stepped back, dropped into a semi-crouching stance, and reached inside her coat. There was a singing noise and a silvery flash, and suddenly she held a 6-foot metal staff in her hands. Corwin had been impressed by that staff the first time he saw it, the night before. He was doubly impressed now. As the Scrang fencer and his half-Minbari opponent opened their clash, he was triply impressed, for this slight, unprepossessing, dark-haired girl knew how to use it, and use it well. The two battled back and forth, round and round, for several minutes.
Skaya was a little faster than Mia, and a little stronger. But Mia's weapon had by far the greater defensive power, and wasn't so far below Skaya's saber in terms of offensive capability either. She was slightly hampered by the fact that, though this was technically a full-contact combat, she didn't want to hurt the Skrang, and so she found herself several times restraining herself from exploiting openings that would have led to parts of her fighting pike making rather painful contact with parts of Skaya's body. Presently, Skaya seemed to realize this. He blocked a jab from Mia's staff, ducked under her counterswing, and elbowed her hard in the midsection, sending her stumbling backward. She regrouped and gave him a questioning look, to which he replied by slapping his tail against the floor and grinning a toothy grin. "No holding back now," he admonished her cheerily. "Anything non-lethal goes in this contest, and as your weapon has no edges, that should give you greater flexibility than I, not the other way round." Mia cocked a tiny, private smile at him, then swept toward him, the tails of her coat swirling around her as she spun, ducked his initial thrust, and laid the butt of her pike across his pointed jaw. The Skrang tumbled backward, righted himself primarily with the strength of his tail, let out an impressed-sounding "cha," and sprang to renew his offensive. For another 30 seconds, his sword and her pike struck sparks off each other as he stopped pulling his blows, and she let her mastery show a bit more. The audience held its collective breath. Any one of those blows sneaking through would do damage to its target, but the two of them were plainly skilled enough to stop a blow dead the instant the other faltered. Skaya finally managed to sweep Mia with his tail. As she fell, the Skrang followed up with a lightning-quick thrust that forced her to parry and bring her pike out of alignment. In the few seconds it took her to get to her feet, he raised his blade, said something that sounded to the onlookers like, "Hivath Kyatse Sklanda!" Corwin blinked as Skaya's sword began glowing a bright gold, and he felt the unmistakable surge of a distinctly alien magic. "What the..." he mouthed, glancing at Nall, who was looking at him. The little dragon shrugged. The fast rattle of blade on pike brought his gaze back to the duel, as Skaya, manic grin set on his face, sped up, parrying and riposting Mia's blocks with superhuman speed. She was staring at him, amazement on her face as she frantically blocked, and then she began to gasp out syllables that only Corwin and Nall understood, though Utina and Kate recognized the language and stared at the girl along with them. "Shadows under the falling leaves," she gasped, blocking frantically as Skaya began to back her toward the edge of the stage. "Drifting white from the night sky, heed... oof!" She interrupted herself, and threw herself into a roll under his blade, coming up halfway across the stage with her pike across one knee in a defensive posture. She raised her left hand and went on, "Heed the voice of she who calls and fly! North wind!" Nall let out a largely strangled yowl and became suddenly flatter on Utina's shoulder, his hackles standing up as if to compensate. Skaya had begun bounding across the hall when the spiraling blast of snow and wind exploded from Mia's palm and caught him, knocking him tail over crest backward and crumpling him against the face of the proscenium. The audience scattered to avoid being bowled over. Mia's eyes widened in concern, and she charged across the room, gasping, "Are you all right?" She was cut off as Skaya, his head nearly cut in half with his grin and shrouded in snow and frost, bounced up, kicked off the front of the stage, crashed into her with his shoulder, and knocked her flat. With the point of his blade, he neatly nipped the rose from her chest, then caught it mid-air, bowed, and presented it to her again. "For the most engaging and delightful duel I've had in some time, my lady, and for the first in some time with anyone who had a crest," he proclaimed. Mia stared at him for a moment, and then laughed quietly and accepted the rose, tucking it carefully into her belt. "What do you think?" Azalin mused to Sionji. "Impressive," Sionji replied. Then he added wryly, "I'd have appreciated it more if I hadn't spent the finale trying to avoid getting a face full of Skrang's saber." "A duelist must always be on his guard, Mr. Sionji," Miki murmured. "So true," Sionji said. "So true." Skaia saluted his fallen opponent with a flourish of his blade, sheathed it, then stepped forward and thrust out his hand. Mia collapsed her staff and took it, and he hauled her to her feet without apparent effort. Amid applause, which was quite impressive given the small size of the group producing it, the two went and faced the president and vice-president of the society, Mia a bit grave, Skye grinning from earhole to earhole.
"Mademoiselle President, Mademoiselle Vice-President," said Skye without preamble, "if this worthy's application for membership in the Institute Duelist Society is not approved, I will be exceedingly disappointed. But as my trust in your judgment is without boundary or question, I know that it shall be after such a performance as that. What say you?"
Caitlin looked at Utina. Both smiled.
"Okay," said Kate. You're in."
"Congratulations," Utina added. "Who wants lunch?" The Duelist Society was well on its way to establishing a post-new member Ping's Garden Run as a tradition. 2 for 2 was, perhaps, a small statistical sampling to work with, but WPI had built traditions on scantier grounds before. Corwin spent most of the meal, when he wasn't joking with his sister, Utina or Nall, giving speculative looks to Mia. A couple of times, he looked like he was about ready to come right out and ask her where she had learned ancient high sorcery, but with the mixed, partially uninitiated company, he didn't quite dare to do it. After the meal, he didn't get a chance. The group scattered, bound for different errands, so he jotted down a mental note to ask her about it some other time. Caitlin, Utina, Corwin, and Nall took Juri Arisugawa out in Corwin's car on a shopping trip to the Greendale Mall. The elegant redhead had only the single school uniform she'd arrived wearing, and that state of affairs couldn't be supported. Luckily, thanks to Megazone's impulsive largesse, it didn't have to be, and over the space of a couple of hours, she selected a decent but not extravagant wardrobe in line with her sharp, rather timeless sense of style. Caitlin stayed with her as consultant on this unfamiliar world's realm of fashion. Though not particularly fashion-conscious, she was a better choice for the role than anybody else in the party. Corwin had the same opinion of women's clothing as he had of fine art. "I don't understand art, but I know what I like." Nall was even more useless, and Utina's idea of off-duty fashion was to dress like she'd escaped from a marching band. Nall stayed as interpreter for Kate's stutter, which would take more than one day's acquaintance she had with Juri to fade to tolerable levels when she addressed the redhead, but he was invited to keep his opinions to himself. Corwin and Utina amused themselves by browsing the gadget, toy, and record shops, then ended up down in the Dream Machine video arcade on the lower level. When Juri, at last satisfied with her sartorial choices, and her companions found them there, they were in the midst of a hotly contested circuit of the downtown course in New Avalon Rush 2404, Rush the Sphere. Juri paused, leaning back against an out-of-order skee-ball table to take in the race with a look of faint amusement on her face. Corwin drove with the classic chase cam view, while Utina seemed to prefer the down-low I-am-the-car angle. Kate shook her head and watched Corwin's screen instead. The grill cam always gave her a touch of vertigo.
I think, she mused after watching Corwin plow into the treacherous center abutment of the Avalon Narrows Bridge and go up in a spectacular semi-holographic fireball, I'll play some Street Fighter.
Her interest peaked. Juri followed Kate to one of the smaller machines in the corner of the arcade. "Street Fighter Super DX3 Ultimate Mega Tournament Championship, Experts of Justice Special Edition," said the glowing sign above the screen. Juri watched Kate plunk in a quarter, select a tall, lanky fighter dressed all in purple, with a rather comical slouch hat and flappy cape, then play the first round, mopping the arena quite handily with a cute little redhead wielding a hammer the size of a Buick. Smiling, Juri remarked, "We have games like this back home. I've never seen this particular one before, but it doesn't look terribly challenging." Kate turned to her, cocking an eyebrow as part of a curious little smile.
Then she dropped a quarter into the Player 2 slot and wordlessly indicated the second control stick. The challenge was on. They emerged an hour later to find Corwin and Utina drinking milkshakes and talking about cars at a table in the food court. Nall was up on the table, flipping through a comic book and looking bored. "About time you guys got done in there," Nall griped as the two women approached the table. "Who finally won?" Jury looked down. Caitlin looked smug.
"Say it," she said.
Jury didn't reply. She merely stood, head hanging, and gazed down at the top of the table.
"Say it,"
Kate snapped, grinning wickedly.
"Caitlin's kung fu is best," said Jury in a small, beaten voice.
Then she gave up the act, smiled calmly, and sat down, adding with sly good humor, "For now." Kate laughed and took a seat.
Loser buys, she said, and Jury dutifully got up again.
Strawberry, said Kate, and the redhead duly reported to the Haagen-Dazs counter. They went back to the Institute, hung around in the wedge for an hour or so, and then Corwin had to leave. He said his goodbyes, and Nall said his, to those who were present. As usually happened at the ends of his weekend visits, Utina accompanied him to his car and gave him a hug before he left. At these times, even Nall excused himself, saying his own goodbye, getting his final scritch, and hopping into the car to give the two humans a moment to themselves.
"Are you sure you're all right?" Corwin asked as he returned the embrace.
She never had told him what had happened to her the day before. All he knew was that whatever it was serious enough that Megazone had involved his Aunt Belle. She nodded, smiling at his concern.
"I'm fine now," she assured him.
"Thanks for asking, though." He wanted to ask, but knew he could never press. So instead, he nodded, then bowed to an impulse and hugged her again.
"See you next week?" Utina asked as he climbed into his car.
He thought for a second.
"Yeah, I think so. Nothing going on that I know of. I'll send email when I know for sure."
"Okay. Well, see you then, probably." She stepped back and grinned.
"Don't forget, you're really driving now."
"I'll try to keep that in mind," he replied wryly, then shut the door, started up, backed out of the spot, and drove off, waving out the window as he did so. Neither of them saw Jury, standing in one wedge window, watching their farewell with a deepening scowl. Edward Tversky and Ein appeared shortly before dinner time, bustling into the wedge from the Institute roadside to stand before wedge booth number one like soldiers reporting from a scouting mission.
"Edward looked into that message you sent yesterday, Azalin," she said, a little breathlessly. "Very, very interesting."
"What about it?" Azalin asked eagerly. She beckoned the hacker to have a seat, grabbed up the corgi in a hug, and went on, "Was it for real?"
Edward nodded.
"Oh, it was for real, all right."
"It really came from Durandal?" asked Kate, impressed.
What does that mean?"
"Well," said Edward didactically, "Durandal is an old Bungiecom Type M cybernetic intelligence. Not very sophisticated by modern standards. No Spengler flux in the core, no genuine free will. Not much better than a decent expert system nowadays. But that's not the reason you don't see them much around anymore. The old Bungiecom systems were really weird. They had a lot of complexity underlying a simple persona. Backwards design, kind of an evolutionary dead end in CI programming before Stasis 2 came out. But because of all the wadges of code and the weird error checking and the Spivernian heroism variances..."
Ein barked.
Right, Edward was getting to that. "And the Strauss logical inhibition uncertainty factor, you could..."
"Ed, I hate to be a pain," said Utina, "but for those of us who aren't genetically engineered genius corgi cyborgs, could you maybe get to the point? In standard, preferably?"
"Sure," Edward replied affably. "Durandal is rampant."
"What?"
Kate blurted, rising halfway to her feet. Feeling the eyes of various other people in the wedge on her, she reddened and settled down, repeating in a quieter tone,
"What?"
"Durandal," Edward repeated, "is rampant. At least that's what it looks like to Edward. His Spivernian variance is off the scale and his data net is expanding exponentially. Edward hasn't completed a full investigation yet, but it looks like somebody tampered with the system's directives and accidentally toppled the Straussian stack index. He's doing a pretty good job of hiding it. The Ops Center has no clue. But while he was in the childish phase Thursday night, he got curious about that list from Minipacks."
"Wow," said Azalin. "I've heard stories about the old Earth AIs going rampant, but I didn't think it could happen anymore."
"It can't with a modern system," Edward said. "What they get for sending an antique to do a toaster's job. Anyway, it's cool. Edward is going to keep an eye on it."
"So, the campus AI is insane?" said Utina.
"Sort of," Edward replied. "But he'll get over it, if nobody crashes him before he can finish."
Stable rampancy is a myth, isn't it?" Kate asked.
"Not if you believe in Traxxas IV," said Edward. "And Edward does, because Edward's met him. Anyway, if the Ops Center or Minipacks finds out about it, they'll shut Durandal down or wreck him. Edward doesn't want that to happen. Edward wants to see a stable rampancy. So does Ayn. So we're going to make sure they don't find out."
The scarlet-haired hacker rose to her feet, zipped up her parka again, and said, "Speaking of which, we'd better get busy, or he might start sending the Ministry of Defense spurious missile alerts or something. He's about due for the angry phase. We'll be pretty busy for a while. Bye!"
Before anyone could ask any more questions, Edward and Ayn were gone.
"Well," said Kate, "this is turning out to be an interesting week."
There was one other notable change that day. In the late afternoon, having tracked down Dean Montaigne at home to get her permission, Mia Ausa moved from a wildly incompatible double in Daniel's Hall to the relative peace of Dorothy's old single room in Galaxy House. Table 11 in the Morgan Hall Dining Commons was, as Devlin Carter observed on Saturday evening, becoming a rather crowded and colorful assemblage. Not everyone came to every meal there, of course. The residents of Galaxy House, for example, had their own kitchen, so the three duelists and one non-duelist IBGF member who lived there didn't have to visit either dining hall for their sustenance. Miki and Moose rarely missed a meal at Table 11, though Moose was absent today. But Skye came only occasionally and was not there this night. As Mia had only moved in there today, her dining hall frequency remained to be seen. At the end of tonight's offering,
I think it's meatloaf, maybe?
Was the final analysis from Utna. Azalin got up, dusted off her hands symbolically, and said, "Well, that's taken care of anyway. Now I have to go get ready for the first night of the summoning of the spring wind."
"You seem to have an observance of some sort almost every day, Miss Azalin," Miki noted, interested.
He stopped his watch, noted the time, and inquired, "How many holidays are on your people's calendar?"
Azalin replied promptly, 524, but not all of them are important. Spring wind is one of the big ones."
She brightened as if an idea had just hit her and asked, "Want to help me out with it?"
Miki blinked. I wouldn't know what to do."
Koichi Sayanchi snickered explosively. Fortunately, he hadn't just taken a bite or drink of anything, or he would have decorated Utena with it. Azalin discreetly stomped on his toes under the table and told Miki sunnily, "Oh, don't worry about that. You'll pick it up easily enough. I don't get hung up on formalities anyway. It's what's in the heart that matters. I think you'll do fine. You don't have a tail, but we can work around that," she added. "Anyway, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do, okay?"
Okay.
"Great. So come by the electromagnetics lab at 8. And don't wear anything with a lot of buttons.
she added, grinning, before giving Sionji a gentle swat on the back of the head and trotting off. Miki watched her go, his face a study in puzzled intrigue, and tripped his watch again before murmuring, "A lot of buttons?" "Well," said Sionji, leaning across the table with a rather dark, sly grin on his long face. "What about it, Mr. Kaworu?" he inquired with faint, good-natured mockery in his voice. "Are you going?"
I'm not sure I should," Miki replied distractedly.
Then he shook his head, blinked, and said, "Caitlin, shouldn't we go over the program for the spring concert tonight?"
I think it'll survive if we take a night off," Kate replied placidly.
"I see," said Miki, sounding unconvinced. Utena shook her head with a bemused smile and stayed out of this one. It seemed the wisest course of action all the way around. "Interesting people," Mia Ausa mused to herself as she walked with her housemate down the hill to Galaxy House after dinner. Miki was still preoccupied, clicking his watch and making little "hmm" noises now and then, until Mia broke into his train of thought.
"Miki?"
He stopped, blinking at her as if just awakened.
"Yes, Miss Ausa?"
"You can call me Mia," she said with a slightly shy little smile. "I was just wondering, are you going to Azalin's observance tonight?"
"Oh, Miki looked uncomfortable. "I'm not sure. I've heard some odd things about her and her religion while I've been here."
What he had heard, specifically, was that Dantrovians were sex maniacs who disguised their revels as religious observances to take advantage of governments, like that of the Earth Alliance, which were perhaps a bit too liberal on the subject of religious freedom. It was murmured in certain quarters around campus that all of Azalin's friends had been drawn into one or another of her ritual couplings over the past year and a half, and that now they were all in her power, either figuratively for fear of blackmail, or literally through some kind of bizarre alien sex magic. That certainly didn't seem very plausible, at least the blackmail or magic part. Miki Kaworu was accustomed to living in situations that had subtexts. He'd gotten pretty good at reading them, and he was quite certain that, though there were some undercurrents beneath the IBGF and the Duelist Society that he didn't have full information on, that was not one of them. Even so, he had to wonder where those rumors had come from, and if they had some vague basis in truth, just what that basis was. Azalin was certainly a flirtatious creature, something that never failed to unsettle Miki slightly, and though her sensuality intrigued him, his curiosity was overbalanced by his reserve. Mia nodded.
"Dantrovian animism is an unusual faith," she conceded. "I've read about it pretty extensively, but never met one of its practitioners before."
She reviewed her memory for a moment, then told him, "For what it's worth, what she said about not having to do anything you don't want to do is a central tenet of Dantrovian religious observances. The Dantrovian philosophy, from what I've read, is very much centered in the individual's will to choose. One cannot enjoy what one has not chosen, and so forth." Miki glanced thoughtfully at her.
"You have quite an eclectic body of knowledge," he remarked after a moment's thought.
Then, reflecting on what he just said, he added,
"No offense."
"None taken," she assured him, smiling. "I more or less grew up in the great library of Yedor, Minbar's capital. All the accumulated knowledge of the Minbari civilization is housed there, but it's not very well indexed," she added with a light-hearted laugh. Miki nodded.
"Dorothy said the uniform you wore for your duel today was a Minbari costume," he said. "I've never seen a Minbari before, but I had the impression that they didn't have hair."
He blinked at himself and blushed a little.
"Oh, I'm sorry. Here I am talking about this stuff.
He shook his head, trying to reorganize his thoughts.
"I'm sorry," he repeated. "I'm not used to non-humans. There are none on my homeworld." It's all right, she told him. At any rate, I suppose it was silly of me to wear my battle uniform if I wanted to keep anything a secret. I'm only half Minbari. My father is an Earthman. Oh. Mia thought it was a bit interesting that this fact didn't seem to faze Miki at all. She didn't know he had no idea it was supposed to be impossible for humans and Minbari to interbreed. It was brave of you to come to Earth at a time like this when all your countrymen have left. They're not my countrymen, Mia replied, a little harshly. At his shocked look, she softened. Sorry, I'd rather not talk about that right now. They were at the front door of the house now. Mia used her key, and as they took off their shoes in the foyer, she went on, For what it's worth, anyway, I think it could be quite interesting, and given the difficulties any Dantrovian has in observing their religion on Earth, that she invited you speaks highly of her regard for you. But if you aren't comfortable, don't go. Miki nodded. I'll think about it, he said. Thanks. You're welcome, said Mia. They went up the stairs together, and then she went into her room to study. Miki stood looking at the door for a moment. Only a month and a half after they'd both come to this place, it already seemed strange to him that it was no longer Dorothy's door. He sighed and went into his room.